Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Tonight it is a Wellness Wednesday, and we are talking about grief, how to deal with it, how it affects especially those in the Black community. Our guest tonight, Dr. Jeff Minzi. He's a lead consultant with Mind on the Matter, and he's a doctor of clinical psychology. And Jamar Wilson, he's the operations director with Roberta's House. And Isaac Lowell, did I get that right, Isaac?
No, Loyal. Loyal.
I'm looking at it and reading it wrong. program coordinator and for All Men's Grief Group with Roberta's House. Isaac, you were making your point about your sort of experiences at Roberta's House and grief, and sort of what you thought grief and how you sort of interpret it and how you speak back to it to those who are dealing with it.
Yeah. For a long time, the way I perceived grief was probably like how many Black Americans perceive grief. The way we handle grief, typically, we get together at Big Mama House, we eat, we laugh, we experience that joy in that moment. We celebrate the life that we have lost, but we never really sit down and talk about the loss. We never really sit down and have the conversation of what that means individually.
Why do you think that is, Isaac?
I think it's been happening so long that it has unfortunately become our norm. And the only way that we can break that norm is by adding these new tools and not being afraid to even talk about it. And I do believe more Black Americans, not even males, more Black Americans are opening themselves up to the idea of therapy and working on themselves. But I think it becomes our responsibility as a community to keep pushing that narrative of opening up the dialogue and conversation.
You know, if I could jump in really quickly on
that
point.
Sure, I was going to ask you. Go right ahead, Doc.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, within our, you know, as African descendants, within our, you know, ancestral cultures, the loss, quote unquote, loss of a loved one or the death of a loved one wasn't considered to be finite and final. It was a part of a continuum. And so our understanding of death and that transition process wasn't necessarily something that was super sad, right? It wasn't something that we would just necessarily go into mourning. We would allot the appropriate time and space and room for us to grieve and to mourn, but it was a part of a larger process that would ultimately end with the celebration of life, which, you know, some of us, we still have celebrations of life instead of funerals. But it was within the larger cultural and ceremonial and ritual context that we found our grief. And so it wasn't to be sad in perpetuity, right? It wasn't like, because we understood, you know, energy was neither created nor destroyed, and that our life is nothing but energy housed in this particular physical form at this time. And then we also had built-in mechanisms to where even when a loved one transitioned from quote unquote life as we know it, they were still accessible as an ancestor. And so there was no need to be down like you totally lost this person and they're absolutely gone, because there was a space within our worldview for the continuation of that life and the continuation of the sport and love that came from that particular life to continue on within our active day-to-day living. And so you find that still, like in New Orleans, for example. You know, you got the second line, you know, you got the parade that goes on with somebody passes. It's not just you're in mourning. And in some African societies, there are literally people who are hired to be criers. They will come and they will cry. That's their role. They come and they cry at the funeral. That's their role, is to carry the sorrow and the grief, to allow room for the family to maintain their high energy levels and then not slip into depression or a misunderstood concept of what it means to die.
Why do you think that's changed, Dr. Minzi? If you see it as changing, is it just inevitable, just the way society moves and shifts?
I think it was intentionally shifted from us. Because, you know, we think about enslavement and the continued oppression. One of the number one things that needed to occur was to take away that which keeps us and makes us strong, and to replace it with that makes us and keeps us weak. So it's almost like if we were Kal-El or Superman, right? Or Superman or Superwoman. And they said, the one thing that makes them weak is, or makes them strong, is recognizing their identity and that they come from another planet and they're actually super beings. So let's take that identity from them, right? And not only that, then now you're just lost. But not only that, but then to tell you that which makes you weak is actually a strength for you. And then they give you kryptonite. They give you a kryptonite grill. You know what I'm saying? They give you kryptonite necklaces, bling, you know what I mean? And it's all kryptonite perpetually making you weak. And so from that perspective, I see it as something intentionally happening to us, you know, especially those populations that are up from slavery, you know, shout out to Booker T. Washington. It's like, you know, when you look at us in the continued perpetuation of our oppression, it's necessary for us to be disconnected from our culture, especially those parts. Because imagine like in a city like Baltimore, so much of the violence that we see is that transgenerational trauma. Right. It is being in the same hood, you know, for generations and hearing gunshots night after night to the point to where you don't even, you know, you might jump the first sound, but you're not ducking and running and trying to get to safety because you no longer feel a threat from it. It's so commonplace. It's so normalized. Like my brother said earlier, some things shouldn't be normalized. Right. You shouldn't get used to certain things, but we have. But when you remove that protective factor, when you remove that sense of self-preservation from it, from an entity, you know, then that entity has nothing to live for and therefore is willing to do any and just about everything. And the life is no longer valuable anymore. So oppression needs that to be our situation.
Jamar, you had mentioned earlier, you mentioned dealing with young folks at Roberta's house. And Loyal deals with men's group and grief. I would think the grief of young people is just so different and even so much more of a challenge. Can you talk a little bit about at Roberta's house and how you all deal with the trauma and the grief that young people have to deal with?
Yes. So primarily we first try to get to identify it. Primarily it's that same systematic repetitiveness of the family goes through the grief process. Maybe the adults may talk about it, may mourn at the funeral, and then life continues afterwards. And oftentimes the children are forgot about, especially when they're at a real, really young age, 4 or 5, it's oftentimes taught to them, oh, that the person is at rest. The person went into a vacation. The person is no longer here in the sense of they won't be around, but it's not really addressed from its entirety in its naturality of saying this person is no longer here. This grandma, mama, dad, whatever has passed away and they will no longer be here as to be a part of your life. And a lot of times that's where the actual trauma starts to begin for children, and they're annihilated from it because they don't have the opportunity to speak up and say how they feel about the loss, what they may even feel. Oftentimes that the conversation doesn't even happen with the child. So we primarily focus on getting the child to understand. We don't try to sugarcoat that the person is, you know, going on vacation, that the person is sleeping for a long time. We really use the actual literal terms of the person has passed away, the person had died, to get the child to understand that death is a part of life. You will experience this, but you have to understand that with death is going to come these emotional issues, may come these psychological issues, may come trauma. Many times for children it's traumatic because they go through life with experiences of graduating different grades, having different accolades, exceeding in life, and they're always going to look towards to have, especially when it comes to a parent, to have that parent be there as they see collectively of their peers around them, that their parents are there supporting them. And then that trauma and that mental process and maybe depression, anxiety starts to build up, and it never really gets addressed because they're not taught at a young age or been given the opportunity to actually engage and speak about how they perceive or what their understanding is, or even be educated about loss. And then that continues on into life, and then it becomes the social norm, and then also transcends into teenage years. A lot of the teenagers think that being from Baltimore and the high murder rates is a cultural accepted, that it's cool to be from this place, that people will respect you when they hear that you come from Baltimore. We have one of the highest murder rates. And then that starts to plant that negative seed and that negative mindset of, okay, this is normal. This makes me cool. This makes me unique when I'm interacting with people, when people find out that I'm from Baltimore, and that when pops and bangs happen, I don't flinch because I'm used to hearing these gun sounds every day in my, you know, in my life, that it becomes normalized. And then what happens, that process continues with the next generation. When they have children, they teach the same colloquialisms to them as they get older. And then that process repeats itself. So we really embed and really teaching them and exposing them to death, dying, and loss and any type of grief to get them to understand that this is going to come with some heavy burdens and some different type of things that's going to affect your emotions. And we want to give you the opportunity and tool to express yourself and understand.
Dr. Menzi, how early can you start with therapy for young people? Is there a specific age or
yeah, and so it depends on how we're defining therapy, right? So, you know, the purpose of therapy is to restore and or maintain, psychologically speaking, psychological well-being in an individual. And so with that understanding, you know, therapy is ongoing and perpetually in place from conception all the way, you know, from the cradle to the grave, you know. So even inside in the womb, you know, therapy should be taking place where there is a positive and healthy environment that the child is able to grow and exist in. And so ideally, you know, the parents are in a healthy state to where the environment itself is therapeutic, helps them to emotionally regulate, helps them to, you know, process real life situations at the level that they're able to, because, you know, cognitive development happens in stages. And so children might not necessarily understand the words that go with talk therapy or a parent trying to explain to them, you know, where grandma is, you know, how they passed away. So that goes back to the story of, you know, they just take their sleep. That's something, because sleep is something that the children can relate to as a concept, you know. But then the great philosopher Nas said sleep is the cousin of death, you know. And so it's a natural connection there, but to help the child in increments to understand this whole cycle of life. But, you know, in the Western sense of therapy, though, you know, children can engage in therapy from, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old with the concept of play therapy, right? Again, it meets them on their level. It allows them to play out real life situations with toys. You know, they can have emotional support animals like a dog or something like that to help to process and emotionally regulate. So again, it can happen as early as necessary, but we just have to make sure that the approach is appropriate for that particular developmental stage and that developmental situation.
Isaac, in leading your men's group, what do you hear from them when they talk about their grief?
For a lot of the men who enter into the group, this is their first time ever being in a setting or an environment where they can share themselves.
And are they mostly majority Black men?
Yeah, majority Black. We have had a few instances of different races, but majority Black. And our group really ranges from 24, and I believe our oldest current member is 75.
Wow.
And that just goes to show you that grief is perpetual. It's not something you go through. I tell my guys that it is a circle. It is something that today you might feel healed, but tomorrow or a week from now, you can be in that same place because it's always evolving and you're always going to have that grief on you. For a lot of these guys, grief has not been an issue that they talked about. It was something, or it was a weight that they carried on their shoulders. And being a man, our general definition of what a man looks like is strength, is how much you can endure, how much pressure you can hold and smile while doing it without cracking under pressure. And for a lot of them, that's how they exist. And it's the identity that they have shaped for themselves. It's the identity that society has shaped for themselves. And any moment, if they sway off that path, they feel less of a, not even a man, but less of a human. So they come into the group very, very pessimistic. And I always say, I say the same thing every time because it works. I tell them, do one group. If you hate it, you can talk about me after you leave. You don't have to come back. I never have to see you again. But after they sit for this two hours and being able to share without any resentment or without feeling judged, they're running back the next time. And it's a 10-week group, 10-week course group. But it's so important. It's so pivotal. It's so mind-changing for these guys. I have people who have returned and are in their sixth group, you know, so 60 weeks of working on themselves. And it's amazing.
And Jamar, in terms of what's happening at Roberta's house, and when we're talking about grief and we're talking about different aspects within the Black community, and Isaac talked about the 10-week support group, it's for adults, but it's also for families too. So do you deal with families sort of as a unit within these support groups? And if so, what does that look like? And what's that experience like if you're dealing with particular families and units?
Yes, we deal with all families and units. primarily we have segments where the family comes in and we divide them up into, you know, what fits for their population. So if they come in, the adults may start their process, the children may be rounded up to start their process. And the reason why we feel that it's important to do that is because, again, a lot of times where, especially in the Black community, when these families coming in, it's kind of that barrier of not feeling safe to be expressive. A lot of times we come from households where it's a stay in a child's place. When grown folks are talking, you don't speak. So they may have these development emotions and innate responses that they want to share and expose, but because their mother or their father might be there, they're more reluctant to say how they really feel. Some of the children may expose and say, I feel like I'm neglected when my grandmother died from my mother, because the mother is grieving her own mother. So it kind of is that barrier that can consistently happen. So we may take the families of the parents and the children, let them be amongst each other so they feel more compelled and open. And there's certain stuff that the parent may feel. Maybe the parent is feeling symptoms of suicidal. They may not want to expose that and say that around their child. So we give them that separation, and then we also unpack those different things. And then we have the collective part where we can bring them together. We also provide mental health services as well, which we do family therapy as well. So we can bring the family in and actually do that through behavioral health services. But we also do that inside of our groups as well. We also have a group for mothers. We just now incorporated fathers where they have lost a child. So that's usually from age 2 and under. So stillborn, miscarriage, preemptive loss, all of that type of things that kind of happens. We actually provide that type of family support for those specific people as well as general laws from homicide, general laws from just dying from different things like cancer or old age or different things like that.
Dr. Menzi, I wanted to also, when we're talking about grief, I've seen two different categories. You've got the 5 stages, right? And then you also have aspects where there's, some would say, 7 stages of grief. The 5 stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. If you add 7, I think shock and testing is also put in there. I don't know if you go by the 5 or the 7, but we could run through all of them. But those stages of grief, real, are stages, should they be added in there? And is 1 or 2 or several more prominent? I say specifically in the Black community of those stages, whether it's 5 or 7, does 1 or 2 or any stick out more than the other or more prominent than the other?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's a very complex question and concept, you know, and it's like what Brother Loyal said, it's a cycle, you know, so that's how they usually describe it. You know, some say stages, but it's really cycles. You know,
what's the difference between stages and cycles?
So typically when you think about stages, you progress from one to the next, and then you get to that final stage, and that's where you are. You know, a cycle is when you cycle through it. You know, you can go through the stages and then you loop back through it. You can go back into this perpetual loop. I'm of the orientation that you can get over grief and loss, and that you don't necessarily, because even like with the model, like the AA model, when you once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic type of thing, I don't necessarily ascribe to the once in grief, always in grief perspective. I'm not against the other perspective. It's just that I just see it just a little bit different, but I accept all of the perspectives on it because they all are beneficial for the most part, and they can help people to advance and become the most healthy and functioning version of themselves in spite of what the trauma or the loss actually was. So when you talk about the 5 versus 7, I mean, when you talk about what might be most prominent, I think that, and not necessarily in a healthy way, but acceptance, going back to one of my earlier comments, to me, acceptance might be the most prominent, but it's acceptance of this position of perpetual grief. I think that we do. And like we say, this is just how it's going to be. This is just how life is, you know, and which also kind of rings of the concept of learned helplessness and learned hopelessness. And to be in a helpless or a hopeless state of mind, it basically undermines the majority of your attempts to advance and do better in life. And so I think that we're in a perpetual mode of negative acceptance, not the acceptance that's empowering, like, okay, accept this as reality and function, continue to function as in this reality, rather than diverting psychological energy to still negotiating whether this actually really happened. Is this the reality? Being angry, being depressed, you know, you get to the point of acceptance, and you move on. That's the empowered way. But I think that we're in a negative state of acceptance that says that this is just my lot in life. You know, when you talk to some of the young kids, you know, in Baltimore, you know, and they, you know, they lost a friend last week. They lost the best friend in school last year, you know, and they just constantly losing people. And so they've come to terms with that loss and that process of loss and saying that this is just what it's going to be. Parents lost a job, lost a parent to like drugs, cancer, incarceration. You know, it's an acceptance of the negative lot in life. So I think that that might be the most prominent stage of grief that we experience in a Black community from that angle. But the other part, I think that is, I think the bargaining stage is very prominent because it's still, that gives you hope, right? It's that whole, because it's after you're mad about not being able to deny it anymore. After the anger has subsided from the denial, you're trying to deny it, but it's still there. You know, the loss, you know, you're still looking over there, the person ain't there, they still ain't answering the phone. You know, they still don't come back to school. Then you start bargaining. Okay, well, maybe they aren't really here. Maybe they just moved away. Maybe, you know, you start trying to bargain with reality. And when you're in a perpetual state of grief and loss and trauma, you know, that gives you hope to still be able to bargain, right? And then that's why after bargaining is depression, because your attempts to bargain have failed. And then that's when you can settle into that piece about learn hopelessness and learn helplessness, right? And then hopefully you can get the proper therapy and guidance through that stage to where you can emerge with acceptance and understanding that this is the reality, but the reality not only includes the loss that you've experienced, but the reality also includes your ability to continue to live your life and actually improve your life and enhance your outcomes in life. So this one loss or trauma does not necessarily have to dictate and determine what happens with the rest of your life. That's the empowering aspect of acceptance. And I think that we don't get enough of that because many of us don't go into these specialized programs like the wonderful programs that Roberta House has going on. You know, many of us don't engage in those programs. Like you said, I drive past that building all the time and didn't know that that's what it was. It's a beautiful place to process, right? And so if we knew that there were more safe spaces like that, Dr. Afia and Billy Shaka, she does something called psychotherapy, where she helps beauty industry frontline workers, you know, beauticians and barbers, to be able to help people to process some of their psychological heavies and their grief. You know, so we enter in those spaces, and if we can get more people competent in those spaces, then we could begin to process more and more out and then find other resources like Roberta's House, Association of Black Psychologists, Progressive Life Center in Baltimore to help us get through these situations and these issues. I hope that's I answered the question, man.
And no, you did. And it was just fascinating. It sounded like a whole nother show when we're talking about barbers and those who work in beauty shops. Yeah. We may inherently know that anyway, right? You go into a barber shop, sometimes we're talking about things and it helps you deal with stuff. You hear what other folks are sitting waiting for the chair, things that they're saying. And Isaac, I saw you nodding when Dr. Menzies was talking about that part of acceptance and maybe the part of like, hey, this is just the lot. This is what it's going to be. And tell me if I was reading that wrong in your body language.
No, I think he hit spot on for my group. And I can't speak for other groups, but for my group, we've started using a model called TEAR, T-E-A-R. And it starts with acceptance. So that the first T is to accept the new reality without the person or with the loss, and then is to experience that pain. A lot of times we don't allow space to experience the pain. Like Doctor said, we see these things happening. We know they're happening. We acknowledge it maybe once, twice, if you have a repast and funeral, and then it's like, let's get on with life. So experiencing the pain is very important. Then the A is to adjust, right? Your life is going to be undoubtedly different no matter what the loss or the relationship was. So now you have to adjust. And that could look like role reversal, role change. So for a lot of our men who are older, we're talking about men who have been with their wives or significant other for years, decades, and having that shell shock of a loss, and now to experience a life where for 40 years, my wife cooked for me. For 40 years, she did my laundry. For 40 years, I brought the money home, but she paid the bills. And now what do I do when all those responsibilities by design and default fall on me? Mm-hmm. So helping them to adjust to that new life that they have to get used to. And then last, we reinvest. So after we adjust, we give them the tools and the coping mechanisms to reinvest themselves within society. with their current position in life. One thing I like most about what you said about acceptance, the thing that I see most in at least my men's group, I guess I would associate it with denial. So it's a lot of anger and a lot of guilt. Those are our two most prevalent emotions when it comes to grief for men. And
anger at what has happened and guilt that, especially if it's a loss, that they could not stop it from happening or whatever that loss was.
Absolutely. I think the most important thing that I try to instill in my men is that we know a lot of words. We know words. But a lot of times, do we know the true definition of the words that we use every day? Yeah. So even with anger, we break the word. I take the definition of anger and I put it on a board word for word, and we break down each word so they can understand what anger is. And a lot of times anger is commonly associated with aggressiveness, being bad. But when we really break it down, anger is just the inability to verbalize yourself effectively. And because of that, it comes out in this visually aggressive manner. So by giving them the tools to be able to say, hey, I am mad because, it takes away that aggression. Even with guilt, what does guilt really mean? Guilt is that self-taken obligation that I should have done something or I failed. And a lot of times with grief, nobody has given us that obligation but ourselves. So we try to break down definitions where for decades on decades, we've been taught a certain way. But if we truly understand what these words mean, we give ourselves, most importantly, grace. We give ourselves some space to grow. And we aren't as hard on ourselves because we have enough people doing that for us.
So. In our last couple of minutes, Dr. Mincy, I wanted to sort of ask very quickly, we've talked about grief really in a sense of a finality, right, of losing people in our lives. But grief doesn't have to just be centered on, the human body, the human experience, losing someone. It could be, losing jobs, a spouse leaving, and grieving through those. And I would assume those are totally different sort of grief processes, but it's still a loss. And I know I'm not giving you a lot of time to sort of comment on that, but is that the same kind of grief as if someone close to you passes away versus losing your spouse or losing a job or losing your life savings?
I think that it is, in a sense. The intensity might vary depending on your dependency on that which you lost, the expectation of the loss or the suddenness of it, but I think that process, when we talk process orientation, it is about the same process. You lose something you needed, it was dependent on that you would rather have kept. So you have to deal with that loss. You have to make those same adjustments. Sometimes it's a guilt about how you came about the loss. Did you ignore certain signs? Did you see the writing on the wall? Did you trick something off yourself? It's just all those things. So I think it's a similar thought process and even experientially, but it's a difference in the intensity of it depending on what the loss actually was in your relationship to that thing or that person.
Jamar, before we leave out, I want folks to be sure that they know how they can get in touch with you if they like and learn more about Roberta's House. How would they do so?
So you could always come by and stop down by the center. Again, we're at 928 East North Avenue, Baltimore, Maryland.
Where?
928 East North Avenue, Baltimore, Maryland.
Baltimore.
202. Or you could call down at the center. It's 410-325-6633. Or you can go to our website, which is robertashouse.org. Email as well, which is info@robertas. That's with the S. House, you can leave apostrophe .org. So you can always email us a referral or anything of that nature. However you need the services, definitely those are all the channels that you can come and get in touch with us. We're not just here at Baltimore as well. We have a location inside of PG. That address will be on the website as well. And all the information in regards to that, we just launched that new office in August last year. We're also looking to do a men's symposium / conference for men coming up in September. So definitely look on the website for that, and we'll have more information for you. far as those different things in the pipeline.
And free.
F-R-E-E. And Dr. Mizzi, if folks wanted to catch up with you, how would they do so?
So on all social media is Dr. Jeff Menzie, M-E-N-Z-I-S-E. And then my website is mindonthematter.com. Mindonthematter.com. Email is drjeff at mindonthematter.com.
Jamar Wilson and Isaac Loyal with the Roberta's House, thank you so much for being with us. And Dr. Jeff Menzie, Doctor of Clinical Psychology and Lead Consultant with Mind on the Matter. We thank you all for a great conversation, very important conversation, and thank you for all the work that you're doing in the community.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity.
That's the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, June 12th. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Have a great night.